You have not heard this song in like 20 years. I don't know if you've heard this song ever. I played this song a lot when I was on my college radio station. What, our college radio station.
Yeah.
Last night I went to a party.
Oh, okay, I know this.
You know this song?
Yes.
Okay.
This is 100 years old, this song?
No, no. We are talking about Robert Mitchum this week. The man, the myth, the legend. This is Robert Mitchum singing Calypso.
Yeah, going, he had a Calypso album.
Yes, he did. Robert Mitchum is a man of many talents, including Calypso singing. This is I Learned a Merengue Mama.
Is he putting on like a weird voice too? Like, why is he doing that? Because that's not even like an island accent he's doing. He's like, almost going Mexican.
I'm imagining he told his agent, I want to do a Calypso album. And he goes, what do you mean? You do westerns and film noir. And he just looked at him and Robert Mitchum looked and said, I'm doing a Calypso album. And I was like, okay, sure, whatever you want. Calypso album.
Is he playing instruments on this too?
Whoa, all of a sudden there's a topless woman.
Oh yeah, Robert Mitchum posing with a topless woman.
What is this doing on YouTube? I didn't know you could have nudity on
this. Apparently you can.
You can?
A friend of mine told me that his son, who's like 8 years old or whatever, Googled sex. Or put sex into a search on YouTube.
Uh-huh.
And you actually find some sexual stuff.
Huh.
Apparently it gets taken down fast, but you can't, it's like, you can't keep up with people who just like,
oh, okay,
insist on like opening accounts and loading it up.
I didn't think about that. That makes sense. But like if you had like a 10-minute short where there was like 5 seconds of butt, how do they know the 5 seconds?
Well,
of
another
butt?
Way around it too is you can do stuff as instructional.
Like here's how to take your underwear off.
Pretty much, yeah.
Pretty much,
yeah.
Yeah. That's a valuable skill. You're gonna need that for your whole life. Our sponsor this week at 100 Years Ago Today. Oh, by the way, this is 100 Years Ago Today, the 1917 podcast. I'm your host, Jeff Ryan, and joining me as always is Vinny Nardiello.
Ahoy, hoy, Jeff.
Ahoy, hoy, Vinny.
All right, I'll make some shots. That's enough of you.
Our sponsor this week is the Clark Bar, which premiered 100 years ago today. Vinny and I have just come back from our small quest to the turn it off.
Yeah,
turn it off.
Yeah, okay. You're shouting over it.
Sorry, Bob Mitchum. So we just returned from a trip to our local convenience store looking for Clark Bars, and there were about 150 different candies, and Clark Bar was not one of them.
No, did not make the cut.
No. Then I went to CVS, which had over 200 types of candy, including Red Vines, which I have never seen sold on the East Coast ever, but they don't have Clark Bars either.
Yeah, Clark is not, I guess, a premier candy.
No. From what I read...
I don't think I've ever eaten a Clark bar.
Really?
No, I don't think I have.
I think I did, but I don't remember that.
I've never been a big candy bar fan. I'm more going for like your Reese's Pieces and M&M's.
Yeah, we Googled it, and the closest thing to a Clark bar is a Butterfinger. So Vinny has bought Butterfingers for us.
Yes.
So we're going to eat them now and tell you what we think of a Clark bar by its Butterfinger surrogate. Mm-hmm.
Do we have copy for Clark bar?
Just eat a candy bar.
Oh. Mm. Dry. Very dry.
Mm. Yeah, I need water.
Yeah. No, I used to eat Butterfingers. I think because I was a Simpsons fan. And I don't remember them being this dry.
No.
It's like eating a sponge.
Now,
this is not good for being on radio.
What? You people don't like wet mouth sounds for an hour? Mm. Yeah, I may not eat the rest of this on air right now.
Mm.
I may save it for later.
Oh. Mm.
But it's kind of like a peanut buttery layer thing. But now I'm thinking of Butterfingers. Now I'm thinking of the whole crispity, crunchity thing.
Mm-hmm.
Clark Bar was bought by Hershey, I believe, like 20 years ago. But then Clark Bar bought themselves out, so now they're independent,
mm-hmm.
which is why you don't see them.
Smart move, Clark Bar.
I don't know if that's a net positive for them. Because you hear lots of deals about people that get shafted out of
mm-hmm.
money. That, like, you know, they have a hit show or a hit product or something, and someone's getting the money for it, but they're not.
Mm-hmm.
So maybe Clark was in that situation. They were like, we're selling a lot of candy, but we're not seeing the money.
There really are only, like, what, like three candy companies?
There's
Hershey.
Hershey.
There's Nestle.
Mm-hmm.
And M&M Mars.
And Cadbury in the UK. Is
okay. All right, yeah.
Yeah.
You know, so they're Cadbury in there.
Yeah.
So, yeah, wait, you're going to go up against them, Clark?
Yeah, when you only have one candy bar, maybe there's like a consortium of all the other loser candy bars, and they have some sort of like
100 grand and
and Good and Plenty, you know, Henry.
You know, I love Good and Plenty.
Really?
I do. I've heard a lot of people say they hate Good and Plenty.
Yeah.
I love it.
I'm a big fan of Good and Fruity, but you hardly ever find them.
Yeah, I don't think I've seen them in years.
No.
No, Good and Plenty I like. That's good movie theater candy.
Now, I'm not a big fan of black licorice, which is the Good and Plenty taste.
Mm-hmm.
But is it some black licorice and some mint, or is it a mixture?
No, just black licorice.
Just okay.
Covered in candy.
Oh, huh. Yeah, I'm now that I'm an adult, I can eat black licorice or black jelly beans without, like, you know, making the I'm dying face, mm-hmm. which is what you would do when you were a kid.
Yeah.
Yeah, but I haven't ever pulled the trigger on a Good and Plenty. But maybe I should.
Mm-hmm.
Maybe I should see.
They had them at Quick Check. We could go.
Oh, but they have a big, big box with them. That's a commitment. I don't want to do that. Okay, on to the week, because I need to get on the road soon. Our small story this week is about Edwin Harris Dunning, who unfortunately died 100 years ago. He set a record. He was the very first pilot to land his airplane on a ship.
Wow.
He was flying a Sopwith Pop, and he landed on the battle cruiser HMS Furious. He did this around England. He was a South African citizen, 25 years old, and he was able to successfully...
Did people fail at it, like, for a while, and then he got it? Or is he just, like, the first attempt, and he made it?
He was the first, and he was also, I believe, the first fatality, because 4 or 5 days later, he tried it out again and crashed and died.
Mm.
And it wasn't like he crashed in a fireball. It's just like the plane went dink, and fell into the water, and he got knocked out, and then his plane sank and he drowned.
Mm-hmm.
Which is not the greatest of deaths. But there's an award named after him called the Dunning Cup, which for a number of years was given out to someone who excelled in aeronautics. I don't know if they're still giving it out, because he died in 1917. No one remembers him anymore. When you give an award like that, it's
I imagine, to commemorate someone. You talk to a pilot, they probably all know him.
I don't think they would, because there's lots of other aviation feats. Charles Lindbergh we remember, because he was the first person to fly across
the Atlantic. Chuck Yeager, yeah.
Yeah, but Chuck Yeager's 50 years later. There were like 100 other pilots who were doing things like what Lindbergh did, except it was the first person to fly back the other way, the first person to do it on a triplane instead of a biplane, first person to do it without landing, first person to do it and land in, you know, France or somewhere. So there's all these records. It was like the Guinness Book was being invented, and it was just a whole bunch of blank pages, and people were just signing up their names whenever they could set a record. And Dunning set the record for first person to land on a plane or land on a ship, and first person to die trying to land on a ship. So he's got two records forever. I don't know if the Dunning Cup needs to be around.
There should be a second Dunning Cup that goes for, like, you know, best death.
Gus Grissom now gets the Dunning Cup because he blew up trying to be an astronaut. Good for you, Gus Grissom. Way to go out like a man. On to our big story this week, the birth of Robert Mitchum, one of the all-time great actors.
And calypso singers.
And calypso singers, yes. He lived a life. I'm going to jump right to the quiz, which is very simple. Can you name 10 Robert Mitchum movies?
No. I'll tell you right now, I can't.
No, you can. You
I'm
can.
Not going to try.
You're not going to... Oh.
I there's no way.
Okay, I'm going to tell you 10 Robert Mitchum movies that you have seen.
Why? All right, well, we do Cape Fear, the original Cape Fear.
Yep.
In there.
Okay, we have one.
All right.
Okay. You have, of course, seen Scrooged with Bill Murray.
That's right,
he's in that. Okay. The very best part of Christmas every year is hearing Robert Mitchum saying the word butthead. the intonation that he gives, the disgust in his voice, it's perfect.
Do you think, all right, I'm thinking about this was the 80s.
Uh-huh.
Was butthead kind of like a curse at the time? I feel like it was.
It was It was like the what douchebag is now. It sounds very terrible, but it's something that you can say on air.
Yeah.
And people just realize, oh, we can put these two words together and say it.
Yeah, because it's the kind of thing I remember, like, you know, like when morning DJs would have a feud.
Yeah.
And they couldn't curse on the air. They would call someone a butthead or a butt munch.
Yeah, or say like, oh, we got some more buttheads in the news today.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know if Back to the Future was the first to introduce butthead into a common lexicon, because Biff Tannen says that a couple of times. But then he said it in the 50s also, so maybe it was a 50s insult that got brought up in what if
the that, 80s. Maybe that was the original name for Jughead. Jughead was originally butthead.
Okay, you've said Cape Fear, you've said Scrooged. Which Cape Fear did you meet?
Well, I know he's plays the cop in the second, but I've seen both.
Okay, so there we go. Three Mitchum movies, Cape Fear. Do you know the love-hate thing?
Well, yeah, no, on the Knuckles.
On the Knuckles, yes. That's a Robert Mitchum performance. That is Night of the Hunter. Okay, so we got four.
You know, it's funny, I in my mind, that was in, what do you call it? Like, I remember that being in,
The Simpsons?
No, Cape Fear.
Oh, in Cape Fear. Oh, De Niro is all tatted up.
Yeah, that's why, because De Niro did that.
Yeah.
And I think he even has love hate on his knuckles.
Right. Did you know that Max Cady was number 28 in the American Film Institute's list of the 100 best villains? And Reverend Harry Powell, who's the guy with love and hate in his knuckles, was 29th. So Mitchum got back-to-back things in the 20s, which is pretty high up there, which mm-hmm. is good for him.
Yeah.
He's also played Philip Marlowe in two 1970s detective movies. He starred in Ryan's Daughter, the David Lean epic, in 1972. Interesting trivia about that. The movie Ryan's Daughter took a long time to show up. I don't think it was ever on VHS, but it finally made it on DVD the day my daughter was born.
Oh.
Isn't that great?
That's the trivia thing?
Yes. Ryan's Daughter came out the day that Ryan's daughter was born.
But how did you even know this? Did you?
Sean told me.
Oh, okay.
My brother.
I'm picturing you in the hospital, like totally ignoring.
I got a great bit of trivia. No, I got to tweet this. It's before Twitter's invented, so I'm just pretending.
Yeah, like, I'm just trying to, like, envision how you came to sound. Like, so I'm picturing them, like, maybe your daughter had one of those, like, what happened on the day you were born? These are the big news stories. And one of the big news stories was that Ryan's daughter finally came out on DVD. Just like, you know, you see the newspaper for the day she was born. That was like the
banner headline.
Big banner headline.
Okay, we will eventually get to 10, I bet. But we have four right now. The 2 Cape Fears, Scrooged, and Night of the Hunter. So, Robert Mitchum, born in 1917. His father died in a railroad accident when he was 2 years old. His mom then found out she was pregnant with his younger brother. She remarried and moved to a farm in Delaware. So if you ever want to know, like, who's a famous person from Delaware other than George Thorogood? Robert Mitchum. Mm-hmm. Bob Mitchum is a Delaware boy.
I'd like to visit the Mitchum farm.
Yeah. He married his high school sweetheart. However, he did not finish high school. He got kicked out for truancy and fighting and all sorts of other things. He then became a hobo for a number of years.
Ooh.
Yeah, he's lived an incredible life. He was arrested. He was put on a chain gang when he was a teenager. He escaped the chain gang, and he got injured in his leg so badly that they were wondering if they'd have to cut his leg off. So eventually he moved to Los Angeles because I think everyone in Delaware was trying to kill him. He built planes for Lockheed in the early years of World War II. He became an extra to do some extra work. Then he got some small Western gigs. Then he signed on to the way the film industry worked in World War II, and like the studio system,
yeah.
was that you'd sign on not just as an actor, but to a specific studio.
Yeah.
And then they'd put you in everything.
Mm-hmm.
And sometimes you'd be in big roles, sometimes small roles, sometimes nothing. But you couldn't go to another studio.
You were an employee of the studio.
Yeah. Yeah, just of the studio. So he was doing Westerns for them. And then his big breakout role was called The Story of G.I. Joe versus Burgess Meredith as Ernie Pyle, who was like the wide-eyed army recruit. And Robert Mitchum played like the world-weary guy who had seen it all, even though he was only like 28.
So this wasn't tied into the G.I. Joe action figure line anyway.
No, but I think G.I. Joe was... the action figures were based on this movie, mm-hmm. or you know, in a way so that they couldn't sue them. But it's weird to think that Burgess Meredith was the original G.I. Joe. I am imagining Burgess Meredith from Grumpy Old Men as G.I. Joe.
Well, he's young. He'd be like him in Twilight Zone.
Yeah.
When he's the guy who wants to read.
Yeah. But he's still not exactly Audie Murphy. He's not, like, brimming with muscles and throwing grenades.
Well, but there was a draft back then. You know, they yeah. just took whatever they can get. Really. You and I could have been in the military at that time. So we're in the podcasting division.
We are keeping the shores safe from stamps.com. So after playing a soldier in Story of G.I. Joe, he was then drafted in 1944. If you're going to be drafted in World War II, 1944 is about the best year to be drafted into it. I read that there were apparently years of problems trying to get people out of the draft. Or out of World War II, because they could only release so many soldiers at a time, and everyone wanted to get out, so there was a lot of processing involved. But some people wanted to stay in, but then they were being kicked out mm-hmm. because they wanted to get the Montgomery GI Bill. Okay, so he serves his country, he's out, and then becomes the king of film noir. He made Night of the Hunter in 1955, where he was playing a reverend on a motorcycle who was also a serial killer, and also the main character, which just never happened that you would film someone so evil and follow them around as a protagonist. He then played a violent rapist in Cape Fear. This was a 1962 movie, and if you watch it now, not only does it hold up, it feels like, how are they getting away with this? Like, the way that he looks at people, the way that he sneers, some of the lines that he says, everything in between it is that this isn't, like, a black-and-white performance. This is a real performance now about, like, the worst person you would ever want to mess with your family. He's in the remake of Cape Fear as well, playing a police officer, as Vinny said. He played Philip Marlowe in two 1970s films. We talked about that. Jumping ahead a couple of decades, in 1982, he stars as a basketball coach, I think, in something called The Championship Season. During the interviews for the publicity for the film, he gets drunk and he throws a basketball at a female reporter. And he knocks out two of her teeth.
Wow.
And she sued him for $10 million. And
so $5 million per tooth.
per tooth, yeah. Mm-hmm. And he settled by giving her everything he made on the movie. Which I don't think was $10 million, but I guess it was...
Enough.
It was enough. Yeah. I haven't seen as many Robert Mitchum movies as I probably should have. Because I've watched my fair share of older movies, but I focus on directors. So I've seen a lot of Hitchcock movies.
I've seen a lot of Ford movies. I want to see all this director stuff.
Yeah. Yeah. I've seen a lot of Kurosawa films. But Robert Mitchum hopped around to different directors. So... The big star of a Robert Mitchum movie was Mitchum. And the big star of a Fellini movie is Fellini, not any of the actors that he casts. Mm-hmm. So I'm still thinking about directors instead of stars. And he was one of the biggest stars of all time. Did you know he was Roger Ebert's favorite actor?
I didn't know that.
No. He was, yeah. Yeah, when he died, I remember Roger Ebert saying that he was his favorite. And he had some fantastic quotes about the philosophy of acting that he had. One of them is that I have two styles of acting, on a horse and off the horse. And then he also said, there's really nothing to acting. You just remember your lines, walk to your mark, say your lines, and then you're done. It's not hard.
I think that's how it was back then. Like, nobody bothered really getting into character. You don't really act, you just memorized.
Yeah. Well, he definitely did get into character, but it was subtle. He wasn't one for like accents or impressions or lips or anything like that.
But whenever you hear a story about Robert Mitchum, it's always, oh, he was like a real tough guy, But the only tough thing he's done was throw a basketball at a woman. I haven't seen any actual evidence of being tough other than being a tough guy in a movie. Playing a tough guy.
What about breaking out from a chain gang? Being in a chain gang and breaking out as a teenager, that's pretty tough. Being a hobo? I feel like you need to be tough in order to do that.
I think you need to just be quick enough to jump on a train.
Okay. Okay, fair enough. Someone wrote a biography about him, which is, I'm assuming this is a quote of his, called Baby I Don't Care, which is such a great name. Like, if I told you there's a book called Baby I Don't Care, you're interested in reading that book.
I'd actually like to market a children's toy called Baby I Don't Care. It's like you're just a baby that you neglect.
I remember hearing that in one of his last films, a Jim Jarmusch black and white western called Dead Man with Johnny Depp, which is a weird, not very good movie. He plays like the sheriff in town of the local law, and he's going to be carrying around a shotgun. And they gave him a choice of three shotguns because they wanted him to get into character. And he's like 78 at this point. And so he looks at the three shotguns and he picks them up and he just picks the lightest one and goes, okay. He did not care at all what it looked like. He just cared about weight because he realized, I'm going to be carrying this around for a couple hours every day. So that was the sort of actor he was. And it didn't read any different. It wasn't like, oh, there's an imposing Old West guy, but he's got a small shotgun, so I'm not as scared of him. He realized that no one cares. He died of lung cancer and emphysema just shy of his 80th birthday. In his later years, this is probably what I first knew him from before I watched Cape Fear or anything. He was the guy who said, beef, it's one for dinner.
That's right.
Yeah.
But then who took it over? Someone took it over. Who was it?
Gilbert Gottfried.
No.
John Lovitz.
No, didn't James Garner did it too.
Oh, yes.
Yeah.
Another tough guy. But he's more of a laid-back tough guy.
Mm-hmm.
But they have the same quality where neither one of them, like, works too hard. You get the feeling that if they saw, like, a robber running down the street, like, at the beginning of Spider-Man style, they wouldn't do anything.
No.
They wouldn't even trip the guy. They'd be like, guess that guy's getting away. I guess that guy, successfully stole some money. Guess I could have done something about it. Guess I didn't.
I'll just throw a basketball at a woman.
So do you have a favorite Robert Mitchum film?
Well, I told you, I haven't seen many, but yes, yeah. I'll put Cape Fear in there.
The original or the remake?
I like them both, actually.
Yeah.
I don't know which one I like better. You know, there's something, you're right, I've seen the original one.
The fact that they were doing it in the 60s against Gregory Peck is... Mm-hmm. Like, as great as the remake is, and I mean...
You know what it is in the remake?
Mm-hmm.
Yes, De Niro's very good in it, but he comes off as a little cartoony.
Yeah.
Like, you don't really feel that real, big threat of him, because there's a cartoonish aspect to it.
Yeah, and you've seen people being threatening in movies for 30 years at this point,
mm-hmm.
because a lot of what he did was the beginning of, like, the Stalker movie.
Yeah.
Which... I think had been around, but it was more like guys who were like Marty, who were like unlucky in love and didn't know how to be around a girl.
Mm-hmm.
But this is the first time they just dialed it up to 11 and said, this is a violent, monstrous rapist, and he is real and is in the world, and the movie is going to end with his death or your death.
Mm-hmm.
On to our next topic. Believe it or not, 1917 is the first year of anime.
Wow.
Anime...
I just took a bite of Butterfinger, and I shouldn't have.
That's okay. Anime, of course, is Japanese animation. But when it doesn't just mean any animation that comes out of Japan. There's a particular style. There's a Japanese-ness to anime. And I always thought that it started in World War II. The legend, the rumor I heard, was that Japan loved animation, and they got all the Disney stuff, they got the Warner Brothers stuff, the Walter Lantz stuff with Woody Woodpecker, your favorite.
Big favorite, yeah.
Yeah.
One of the big three.
One of the big three. But then when World War II happened, they stopped getting all of the Disney stuff.
Did Japan have their own, like, propaganda cartoons? Like, you know, like, Bugs Bunny with the Japs, that was one of them,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah,
yeah. Is that offensive that I said that? I think it's the actual name of the cartoon.
It is, yeah.
Yeah. You know, did they have their own, like beloved character who would, like, you know, go around, like beating up a cartoon FDR?
Yes, they did. I'm going to get his name right.
But was it Hello Kitty?
No, it's something like Momotaro, and he was a boy who was friends with lots of animals from... from like a picture book, but he would open the book and the animals would jump out and they'd have adventures together. Mm-hmm. And there is a cartoon where evil, sinister, imperialist Mickey Mouse comes and attacks Japan, and Momotaro and his animal friends need to defend Japan against Mickey Mouse.
So Mickey was very, like, identified as, like, an American icon.
Yes. Yes. In fact, he is the American icon of the whole 20th century.
I don't remember any cartoons where Mickey went against the Nazis. No. Like, I was Bugs Bunny, I remember doing it.
Uh-huh.
I remember Daffy Duck doing it.
And Donald did it.
Did Donald Duck do it also?
Yeah. Yeah, that, Donald Duck in Nazi-land. That's, like, the definitive...
Oh, so, yeah, where he has a dream where he's a Nazi, right?
Yeah. Yeah. So Japan made anti-American propaganda cartoons like in the late 30s and early 40s. But 20 years before that, they were at the coal front of animation. They were at the very beginning of it. Vinny and I just watched a very short, it's like, by short, we mean like 15 seconds long.
Well, yeah, cartoons back then were just very, they like, had the dinosaur that ate trees.
Yes, that was Gertie the Dinosaur from 1914.
Mm-hmm. And the clown that jumped out of the inkwell.
The clown that jumped out of the inkwell.
And those are the only cartoons.
No, that was it. Yeah. So this is after Gertie, but it predates the Coco the clown jumping out of the inkwell.
All right.
This,
if you go on YouTube, it's printed in Japanese
old animation, 1917.
Yeah.
What's amazing about this is that it has a yellow background. Obviously, they filmed in black and white, but they printed the negative on a yellow film stock, which is what they did back then. There weren't any true black and white films. They would always pick a style color. So if you watch a scene that takes place at night, they had it against blue stock. If you watch a scene that takes place during a fire, they had it against red stock. So
kind of was like Don Rickles, the...
Yeah, there's two guys. One of them is a samurai, and he's sneaking up on like a painter or some philosophizer who's unaware. And they have very, very distinctive faces. And they're oversized heads, the way that cartoons are. But it's also paper doll animation, so it's like cutouts that are then being pivoted.
Like South Park style.
Like South Park style, no. Yeah. So the very first cartoons were like this.
All right, so the samurai sneaks up on him.
Yep, lots of small, subtle head movements. And eyeball movements. This stuff is—it's not hard to do, but it's hard to think about that you need to show the characters looking at each other.
And the painter just kicked him in the head.
The painter kicked the samurai in the head, so the painter was aware, and it looked like he wasn't, but he was, and he got the best.
Did people actually go to like a movie theater just to see this? Like, they got this great 17-second cartoon we have to check out. Like, where is this shown? Where is this distributed? Like,
I know, like the old Thomas Edison Black Mariah days, they would do that. They go into a special room just to watch a man sneeze. And they pay 2 bits for the privilege of watching a man sneeze.
Now, you're pretty much into every nerdy thing that there is.
Yeah.
But you're not into anime.
No. Partly that's because I'm not Japanese, and partly that's because...
There are a lot of people who aren't Japanese or into anime.
No, but anime is like a broad umbrella for a number of subcategories. I could decide to be in one particular subgroup of anime, and that would be 40 hours a week for the next 5 years, and I would only plumb that one category. It's like saying I want to get into like
so you're into Harlequin romance. Hentai is your thing, right?
No, I'll keep it PG. If I wanted to like Harlequin romances, I can read just about cowboys. I can read nothing about cowboy sex forever. And then if I want to read about pirate sex, I can read nothing but pirate sex.
So I don't understand why this means you're not into anime.
Because there's so many categories, and most of them I am as interested in as reading about pirate sex.
So you have your. Here's what I'm gathering here. Mm-hmm. You have this kind of like OCD of completionism.
Yes.
And there's just too much.
That's an excellent point. Yeah. If you show me a Naruto book, it's like, oh, this looks great. And when you show me like Naruto book 48, and they all have very similar spines, like, yeah, you can just start at number one, go all to 48. Like, I'm not starting
you
number
know,
one.
You know yourself, you can't.
Yeah. I still have not read Dune, one of the foundational science fiction books, because they wrote like 8 sequels that got worse and worse. And I will never be able to cut bait. I will keep going as bad as they are. Up until, like, his grandson stops writing the books.
See, I have no problem giving up on something, like a TV show, and just going, I don't like this anymore. No issue with that.
I have a big issue with that. In fact, I have a very passive-aggressive thing, where if there's a show I don't like, I will stop watching it. Not actively, but passively, so it's still taping on the DVR, and I will then hope and pray that it will, like, backlog five episodes, and then start auto-deleting them. Mm-hmm. And then once I've lost an episode, like,
that's not your fault.
Yes, yes, I've washed my hands clean of this. It's not my fault. It's the DVR that deleted it for me. Now I can't watch Glee anymore. I love Glee, and at no point did I want to stop watching Glee. It's just the DVR told me I had to stop.
This is like, I think that might be the shared nerd quality that, like, most nerdy people I know have, mm-hmm. is that desire to, like mine every bit of information about, not just, like, they're not just going to watch, they need to know everything in the Star Wars universe.
Right.
You know?
Right. Watching Star Wars isn't enough.
Well, that's why I've always felt that the nerd stereotype is actually autism.
I can...
Like, what we...
Well, we define autism as looking at the world.
Or Asperger's-y kind of thing. Like, but we didn't... Like, we didn't have Asperger's in the 80s, so we just, like, that's a nerd. You know.
Well, you don't mean that there weren't people with Asperger's. But
we didn't define it, though. But we didn't define it. We just went, oh, that's somebody who's clearly a nerd. In reality, like, Eddie Deason was a noted Asperger's actor. He was playing somebody with Asperger's in all those 80s movies.
So, I think about Eddie Deason far too often, because... When I read to my kids, I have, like, a couple of voices.
One of them's Eddie Deason.
One of them is basically Eddie Deason. I've read a number of series where Eddie Deason is one of the main characters, mm-hmm. because in my head, that's what a 10-year-old sounds like.
Well, no, I think the thing that we think of as being nerd culture, like mm-hmm. sci-fi, it's really Asperger's culture, because it's something that people really, like, you know, can get into and learn the universe and, like, you know all the characters and the trivia and the minutia of.
Now, I've heard someone describe the autism level disorders as being at a sort of remove from the rest of reality by looking at the world the way that you would watch a TV show, where you can feel some sympathy for the characters and you want to know what's going on, but you don't empathize with them the way you would someone in your living room.
Mm-hmm.
And that happens even though it's someone who is in your living room.
Now, see, but that's not you, because you're an empathetic man.
I am.
Far more than me.
Yeah.
You know, you're below beta male.
I'm gamma male?
You're gamma male.
Oh, and there's a gamma male joke in there, but I don't remember who gamma male is. Should I look it up?
I don't know. You're the name chamomile.
Maybe he's a... I think he's a World War II guy. Gamma... I'm trying to type, holding the microphone with the other hand. Gamaliel, oh, it's a leading authority in the Sanhedrin in the early 1st century AD. No, I'm totally wrong. Gamaliel is from the Bible.
Oh, okay.
Okay. Means reward of God in Hebrew. Speaking of reward of God, we are rewarding you with a slightly shorter episode.
Jeff has to, 100 years yeah, you have to hit the road.
Yeah, I have to hit the road. Oh, and it sounds like the police are out to get me. Very first time anyone has ever made that joke, and you got to hear it here in 2017. Anyone who has made the joke afterwards has to pay me 25 cents. Original thoughts coming from this podcast. We will talk to you next week when we will be back from vacation and talking about the final days of August. Until then, ahoy hoy.
Ahoy hoy, Jeff.